A BYD está com ofertas para você levar um elétrico ou híbrido novinho para a sua garagem. Vá a uma concessionária e faça um test drive. BYD, construa seus sonhos.
Olá, muito bem-vindos. Nosso convidado de hoje mudou a história do pensamento. Pensando sobre como pensamos, psicólogo de formação, ele acabou ganhando o Nobel de Economia. Durante décadas, ele estudou em profundidade nosso processo de tomada de decisão. E não é que tenha chegado à conclusão de que somos irracionais, não. Mas ele demonstrou que a racionalidade não é bem o que pensávamos. Depois de se tornar best-seller mundial com este livro sobre nossas duas formas de pensar, rápido e devagar, agora ele vem sacudir nossas frágeis certezas com ruído, uma falha no julgamento humano. Fazendo uma simplificação meio grosseira, um brevíssimo resumo do livro, podemos dizer que ruído é tudo o que é externo a uma decisão, mas influencia essa decisão. Exemplo, o estudo de 1,5 milhão de decisões da justiça americana revelou que o peso das sentenças pode variar por coisas banais como se chove lá fora, se é antes ou depois do almoço, ou acreditem, se o time do juiz perdeu ou ganhou no dia anterior. Mas por que isso acontece? Nosso convidado traz algumas respostas. Sem nunca ter frequentado aulas de economia, ele figura entre os pensadores econômicos mais influentes da história, como Smith, Marx, Keynes, Hayek e Friedman. Que privilégio conversar com Daniel Kahneman. Professor Kahneman, I'm thrilled by this opportunity. Thank you so much. Professor Kahneman, for those who may find odd a psychologist becoming one of the major economic thinkers of all times, what would you reply? Would you say that economics have always been about psychology, or that our psyche functions in an economic frame?
Well, in the first place, let's not exaggerate my importance in economics, but I would say clearly economics makes psychological assumptions, and the assumptions of standard classical economic theory are not realistic, and basically our work has been to introduce some realism into the assumptions of economics. It's not revolutionary.
How did you realize your psychology works were leading you, were taking you to the economic field?
It didn't. I started doing economics very late. When what happened was that Amos Tversky and I were doing psychology, and we were studying decision making as psychologists. We published in a journal, Econometrica, which is a prestige journal in economic theory that also publishes decision theory. And the reason we published there was not to influence economics, we didn't have that in mind at all, but simply because that's a good place to publish good articles in decision theory. So the rest, what happened is that economists became interested in us. It's not that we were trying to influence economics.
Let me grab your books. It's in the table beside me, the Brazilian editions of Fast and Slow. So our far ancestors in the African savannah, did they survive thanks to fast thinking?
Oh, certainly. Primarily fast thinking. But, slow thinking is necessary for culture and for reasoning and for many other things.
Which kind of decisions are made by fast thinking we do in everyday life?
Just about every decision that you make. I mean, the fast thinking, even, let me put it this way, the way that words come to your mind in this conversation, this is fast thinking. You're not planning the word, they just come out. So fast thinking is not only reactive, it is associative. it is the functioning, the automatic functioning of memory. So it's not only primitive things, it's highly advanced things, like thinking of the words you're going to say, or having an intuition about a complicated problem, or driving a car, or doing many other skilled activities. All of that is fast thinking.
It's like in instances that we don't think about thinking, we just do it. When we stop and let's think about it, and that's slow
when
thinking.
When you stop to think about it, that's slow thinking, certainly.
Yeah. Listen, how would you define this thing we call intuition?
Well, there is a standard definition of intuition, and the standard definition is wrong in an interesting way. The standard definition is knowing something without knowing why you know it. That's a standard. But it's wrong, because that is what can be said to know something only if it is true. But intuition isn't always true. So intuition really is believing that you know something without knowing why you think you know it.
It's like I was reading the other day about implicit learning. It's knowledge, not non-academic knowledge. Like an athlete, if you ask an athlete how does he run under 10 seconds, 100 meters, he wouldn't be able to explain. So it's an aphorism that says, one knows more than one can tell.
A lot more. I mean, this is even true of simpler skills like driving a car. I mean, if you stop and verbalize everything that you do when you're driving a car, you couldn't do it. So most of our skilled activities are too fast for language.
But usually people associate slow thinking to a much more sophisticated way than the fast mode. But is it necessarily better or superior, slow thinking?
Well, in the first place, slow thinking isn't the same as rational thinking. This is a mistake that many people make. Slow thinking is just slow. It is reasoning and it demands effort and it's hard work, whereas fast thinking is not work. There are many mistakes that people make in slow thinking, so there is no guarantee that if you think slow, you're going to think correctly.
A common misunderstanding about your findings is the conclusion that as humans don't make decisions only rationally, therefore humans are not rational. What is rationality, Professor Kahneman?
Well, the way I use rationality is a word in the language. And in the language, all it means is something like reasonableness. And there's no question that by and large, people are fairly reasonable. Rationality is also a technical term. It's a technical term in decision theory, and it's a technical term in economics. And as a technical term, it means that you make decisions and you have beliefs that follow certain rules. They follow certain axioms. And the basic idea is they're internally consistent. That is, all your beliefs and all your preferences are internally consistent. That is the main condition for rationality as a technical term. But it's clear, when you think as a psychologist, people cannot be rational by that definition. So by that definition, people are not rational. That doesn't make them irrational. That's a word I hate, the word irrational. Irrational means that you have no control over what you're doing, that you're acting completely emotionally. I'm not interested in irrationality, but I'm interested in behavior that is not completely rational in the technical terms, where people make mistakes, and they make mistakes because of the way that they think intuitively, and that's what I find interesting.
It seems that in some so-called rational decisions, emotions play a great part. So would awareness, to use this word, be a conscious state motivated by emotional process, unconscious and emotional processes?
Well, as I said, in the technical term of rationality, the only constraint is really internal consistency. So that you're allowed to have any beliefs you want, you're allowed to have any desires you want, so long as you're consistent about them, you're rational. So that is part of the classical economic point of view, which is associated with the idea of freedom, that and with the idea of personal responsibility. It's a right-wing idea, the idea that people are rational, because they are supposed to be logical, they're supposed to obey the rules of logic, but otherwise they can have any beliefs and any wishes that they want. In the psychology, it's much harder to separate cognition from emotion. Whenever you have a thought, typically a lot of that thinking comes automatically. A lot of that thinking is in system one. That those are associations and memories that you are not producing actively, they just come to your mind. And emotions also come to your mind. So, you know, if I say your mother, then something happened to you. You have emotions about that word, and you cannot think about your mother in a completely unemotional way.
I find it very touching, very beautiful, the history of your story of your friendship with Amos Tversky. He died in 1996, and you won the Nobel for Economics in 2002. How was Amos present that day in Stockholm?
Oh, he was completely present. I mean, it was clear that I got the Nobel on joint work. And all of Amos's, I invited all of Amos's family. They were all in Sweden. And so he was certainly present.
And what was this bond between you two? What emotions fueled and guided this intellectual partnership between you two?
We were very lucky that we liked each other, and we found each other interesting. And Amos was always funny, but something happened to me when I was with him. I also became funny. So we were really enjoying every minute that we spent together. And so that was really the secret. The secret was that we enjoyed it so much. And we enjoyed talking, and both of us were pretty talkative, and we talked and laughed all the time. And we did work as part of that. Amos had some skills that I didn't have. He was a better mathematician. And I had a few things that I did better than he did. But the main thing was that together we thought better than either of us alone. What happened between Amos and me was that he understood me better than I understood myself. So I would say something, and he would see much more than I did when I said it. And that is a real joy. This is, for somebody who thinks for a living, this is extraordinary, that somebody helps you think. And I was helping him think too. So that was the magic that we had for a while.
It's beautiful. You have said that your interest in psychology was born out of a proximity to interesting gossip. And that sounds familiar to a journalist. Gossip is the mother of all psychology.
You could say that. Not experimental psychology, but yes. And for me, certainly my interest, if you're very interested in people, and if you're interested in complexities, that is, that people, it's not black and white, it's not black or white, it's black and white and gray and everything else. So it's a complex mixture. And I was exposed to the trial. My mother was a gossip, and she was an interesting gossip. People were complicated, and that was interesting.
Life is the realm of ambivalence. That reminds me of that story. You were a Jewish boy in Nazi France, and then you have a close encounter with an SS officer.
Yes.
How did you get away with it?
Well, yes, I was seven, and there was a curfew for Jews, and we had to wear a yellow star. And I was playing with a friend, and I stayed too late, so it was after the curfew. So I put my sweater inside out, and I walked home. And near home, and I still remember the place, there was walking toward me a German soldier, and he was wearing a black uniform. And I knew that they were the SS, they were the worst of the worst. But when we came close to each other, he called me. He beckoned me with his finger. And I came near him, and he picked me up and sort of hugged me. And then he put me down. He opened his wallet, and he showed me a picture of a little boy, and he gave me some money. And then we went our separate ways. And I told that story in an autobiography, and it's that I had to write for the Nobel. You have to write an autobiography when you get a Nobel. I had to write that, and that's what people remember the most, but it's not that it was the most important thing in my life, but it certainly was an example of how complicated people are. And I remember that was part of the experience, of thinking about the experience immediately, was nothing is simple. Here is a murderer, but he has a boy, and he loves the boy, and that was interesting.
It's also could be also an example of noise in the sense of your book, because this officer's judgment was affected by this memory. Was it a noise? Could we say that?
No, not quite. There is a real problem with terminology in my field. So the word bias means many, many different things. And the word noise is terrible that way, because everybody has an idea of what noise means. We mean something very... Noise actually is a technical term, the way that we use it. We use it not as it is used in the language. And that probably is... That may be a problem with the title. But we use it as if we... like the word rationality before, it has a technical definition. And the definition is variability in judgment that shouldn't exist. And it's easiest to think about if you think not of judgment, but of measurement. Because when you're measuring length or you're measuring weight or whatever it is that you measure, so there is an object out there, there is some reality, and then you have a scale, an instrument, and you apply the scale to the object, and you come up with a measure, with a number. Now, when you repeat that measurement, if your scale is fine enough, you are not going to get the same number. It's not going to vary a lot, but ultimately, there always is some variability, even in the most precise of instrument. That variability is noise.
I thought that noise would cause this variability.
No.
So no, it's the variability itself.
The variability is noise. And my example is an insurance organization. And you have underwriters who assign value to risks and to premiums. You would want the organization really speaks through its underwriters, and you would want the organization to speak in one voice. That is, you would want any two underwriters who look at the same problem to come up with approximately the same number. Now, people know that they're not going to come exactly with the same number. But I had a question when I was studying this. I asked people, if you take two underwriters at random and you've given them the same problem to a lot of underwriters, it's an experiment we ran, 50 underwriters looking at the same problem, putting a dollar value on it. If you take two underwriters at random, by how much will they differ in percentages? And people have an answer. They say about 10%. That's what people expect. It looks reasonable because you don't expect them to agree perfectly, but you expect them to be close to each other. Now, the correct answer was closer to 50%, five times more. That's why we wrote the book. We wrote the book because there is a lot of variability and because people don't know how much variability there is.
Bias is a cause or a consequence of noise?
Well, what you often have is one part of noise is individuals have biases. So if you have judges, some judges are more severe than others, or some judges are particularly upset by when the victim is an old person. So the judges have biases, which each judge has their own biases. The biases are not the same. And the variability of the biases, that causes noise. It's if everybody had the same bias, then there would be bias and only bias. But when they have different biases, that's noise.
Noise, then it's another thing. It's like if it's raining outside or if the judge had lunch or not before the sentence.
Yeah.
This is noise that can affect and affects his decision.
So there are really those two kinds of noise. So there are actually three kinds of noise technically, but there is noise within the individual. That means that when you show the same problem to the same individual on several occasions, they don't come up with the same number, depending on whether they have had lunch or in a good mood or in a bad mood or actually on what they just, on the decision they just made on another case. Because if they were severe on another case, they're likely to be lenient on this one. So there are many internal effects like this that cause variability within the judge. The noise that we are most interested in, actually, is the noise between people. It's the fact that people are looking at the world and they think they see the world in the same way, because every one of us thinks that we see the world the way we do because that's the way it is. But in fact, it turns out when you study it that there are huge differences among people in how they see the world. And they're much larger than we expect. It's difficult for any one of us to imagine how other people can think what they think. And that's because we have our personal reality and we think that anybody who is reasonable is going to see the same reality, but that's not necessarily the case.
About decision-making, now some people bet that algorithms and even AI will become better decision-makers than people. What's your view on this?
Well, I mean, it depends very much on the domain. There are many domains where this is already true. So algorithms play chess better than people. They play Go better than people. They detect breast cancer in some cases better than radiologists. They detect retinal anomalies better than ophthalmologists. And the list goes on and on, actually. And furthermore, the list is getting longer every year. So every year, there are more things where AI is approaching human abilities. And when AI approaches human abilities, give it some time and they will be better than people. And the reason is that artificial intelligence has an opportunity to learn more than any individual has. I'll give you an example because that's abstract. If you have robots living in families like pets, they would learn about the emotion in the family. They would learn to predict when a quarrel is going to happen or when it's about to end or who is hungry, or they will learn a great many things. But the interesting thing about these robots is all of them are talking to a central computing organization, so which collects all the experiences of all the robots in all the families. So the rate at which robots will learn about people once they live with us and have an opportunity to hear our voices and to look at our faces, they will develop emotional intelligence much better than people and much faster than people. And I think that's just a question of time. It's an example. And that's because of the speed of learning. It's the same thing with self-driving cars. I mean, they haven't solved all the problems, but self-driving cars, any experience that one car has, it's centralized. It goes to Tesla. So all the Teslas in the world are all learning together. And that is a huge advantage of algorithms over people.
Even to take, even when faced with moral decisions, that's one thing that is about a self-driven car. If it has to brake and hurt people inside a car or to kill someone who crosses in front. I don't know how would that moral... How can it be morally fed?
Well, there are sort of standard problems. Problem, it's called the trolley problem. There is a trolley car and it's on a track where if it goes on that track, it's going to kill 5 people. But you have a lever and you can send it on another track where it will kill 1 person. Now, should you do it? Shouldn't you do it? Now, and there's a lot of debate about that. But most people in that case, I think that it would be a good thing to do to save the 5 at the expense of 1. The point is, you will teach cars to make those decisions in the same way that people do. In fact, there has been already a very large problem on people's intuitions about those kinds of issues. And the object of that problem was to educate self-driving cars. So self-driving cars are going to have human morality built into them.
Don't you find it a bit scary?
I think the world is scary. It's not the scariest thing, I think of it. But it's quite scary in the sense that what it's going to do to humanity, the progress of AI, is that, we know it's happening. It's happening like climate change is happening. What that is going to do to society is nobody really knows. But it could very well be very bad.
Professor Kahneman, this year in Brazil, we are running through a campaign, election campaign. You probably noticed.
Yes.
How conscious is a voter when casts one's ballot?
Well, I mean, it's the decision of the voter is a very personal, emotional, social decision. I mean, the fact is that people are members of groups. And now every one of us, we think that, we have this belief. If I ask you why you vote in this way, you'll give me reasons. But the reasons that you will give me are not the real cause of your voting. They're just stories that people tell themselves. The reason that we vote the way we do is very largely because are the people around us, the people we love, the people we trust and are attached to. And that determined voting much more than, you know, analytical thinking.
Thank you so much, Professor Kahneman. As a last question, what would you reckon is your will be your greatest legacy to science?
Oh, you know, I think clearly the most significant thing I have done in terms of contribution is in the book Thinking Fast and Slow, because that has been read by many people, sold millions of copies, but not everybody who's bought the book has read it because it's a hard book, but many people have bought it. And it has had some impact on the profession and on other professions. It's not the most original work I've done in terms of original research. That was the work I did with Amos Tversky. But in terms of my contribution, I think it's probably the most influential. Yes.
Thank you so much, Professor Kahneman. Have a wonderful time in Brazil. I hope
you
enjoy yourself. And okay, it was really a pleasure, great honor to talk to you.
Thank you very much. Bye-bye.
Goodbye. Para você em casa, alimento para a cabeça. Um bocado de coisa para a gente pensar, né? Até a próxima. Quer ver mais? Entre no Globoplay.